You had written that your main qualification for writing this book as a well-meaning white guy who went to school in Vestavia Hills, one of your main qualifications was ignorance. You knew that you didn't know a lot and you had a lot to learn. Now you're on MSNBC talking about racial issues, considered an expert. What does that turnaround, what does that change feel like for you?
You know, it's hard for me to remember how ignorant I used to be. And I wouldn't call myself an expert now. I just call myself an informed, normal person. So, you know, I haven't really changed that much as I've evolved. And I think my ignorance that I brought to the subject in tackling it was good in the sense that most people who tackle race do so from an ideological point of view, whether it's black or white or liberal or conservative. They go in with a lot of preconceived notions about what it's going to be, and that shapes how they interpret everything. And almost everything written about race is written from an ideological point of view, defending affirmative action or tearing affirmative action down, or, you know, defending diversity or talking about, you know, the opposite. So it's very difficult to sort of form your own opinion based on just empirical evidence, because everything about race is politicized. And so the fact that I came in really sort of woefully ignorant without a whole lot of preconceived notions really sort of helped me look at things with a fresh perspective and say, okay, well, this is true, that's not true, that's useful, that's not useful, and sort of give a fresh take on things, which is what I feel like people have responded to. So when I go on shows like, you know, on MSNBC, I'm not really there as an expert. I'm just sort of there to be a normal white person. Because most normal white people don't go on TV to talk about race, because one of the defining things about being a normal white person is not talking about race.
Right. And in your book, there's a line about the second most entitled species in the world. Do I have that right? Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the school busing was put in place to sort of corral white people and keep them in the public school system. And, you know, it didn't work because, you know, people can move. If you have money, you can just leave and go live somewhere else where, you know, the law can't really touch you and form, like Vestavia Hills and Mountain Brook did, separate school systems. And so, you know, I sort of made the joke. I said, well, this is like herding cats, you know, to use the old phrase. And I thought, well, wait, no, it's kind of like it's worse than herding cats, because white people were Earth's only species with a greater sense of entitlement than a cat. And that was just sort of a clever little line I thought of along the way, and people seem to like it.
Yeah, I can see why. Speaking of schools, tell us about your time coming up in the Vestavia Hills school system.
I moved there in eighth grade to start going to Posit, and before that I'd gone to a very, very, very small private school. So it was a bit of a culture shock in that way. But, you know, the defining characteristic as far as race goes back in those days was that it just wasn't talked about. One of the things that's certainly true about Vestavia now is with the election of Barack Obama, certainly things have gotten better for the black students there, but in a way there's more, you know, overt racism, because there's a lot of anti-Obama stuff among the students in the school. Whereas when I was there, like, race just wasn't talked about. The black kids were bused in. They sat in their own part of the hall. We didn't talk to them. They didn't talk to us. And they sat on their own table in the cafeteria. And then at 3:30, they went home.
Sort of less threatening? Societal change wasn't quite as obvious in Vestavia back then, maybe a little less threatening?
No, I think it was just, you know, it was oil and water. You know, it was two completely different cultures. You had two very, very different income groups. You had, you know, kids in Vestavia were very well off. Kids from Oxmoor, which is where the kids were bused from, were very not well off. And so we just didn't mix. And they rejected us, and we didn't really reach out to them. And that's why, in many ways, school busing was a failure, in that, you know, we put kids in the same building, but we didn't really encourage them to interact in any way. And if you're not going to interact socially, then, you know, what was it all for?
Right. Now, the other three parts of your book, there are four parts, education and housing and real estate, advertising, and church. The second part, the housing and residential part, first tell our listeners who may not be familiar with these terms, what exactly is blockbusting?
Blockbusting was the practice by which unscrupulous real estate developers would use white people's fear of black neighbors to scare white people off in order to flip houses and sell them at a markup to black residents. And black residents at the time had been, you know, cordoned off into ghettos in major cities and in had really subpar living conditions. So there was a huge, huge pent-up demand for housing in the black community. And so after World War II, you know, blacks started pouring out of the ghettos and reaching out to look for better and more decent housing. And, you know, real estate developers knew that white people would be terrified of black people moving in. And so they did their best to exploit that fear. You know, oftentimes the real estate developer would buy a house, rent it to a black person, and they wouldn't just rent it to, you know, a black doctor or a black lawyer or a black school teacher. They would find really the most unsavory, most stereotypical black resident they could find and put them in the house deliberately to scare white people off. When in fact it seems to, you know, been natural and organic, you know, only a black doctor or a lawyer or school teacher would have been able to afford that house in the first place. And so then once this new black neighbor would be moved in, then they would start calling all of the local neighbors late at night and saying, you know, black people are moving in, or do you want to sell? Because the property values are going to go down. Well, it's just like starting a panic on Wall Street. Once you start a stampede, prices drop and people are afraid of their, you know, income, their property values going down. So this myth of black neighbors lowering property values was born. It's not actually true. Real estate developers drove property values down by ginning up fear of black neighbors. But it wasn't actually the arrival of black neighbors that did that. And so, you know, it was actually, you know, taking advantage of both white and black homeowners. Because you had a lot of older white homeowners on a fixed income. Most of their equity was tied up in their house. And they would get in a panic and, you know, sell their house in, say, Woodlawn for below market value. Their house was worth $10,000. They'd sell it for $8,000 just because they were scared that they would get even less. And then they'd have to move out to somewhere like Homewood or Hoover and buy a house for $12,000. So the white family was losing money in that deal. And then the black family would move into this house that the developer scooped up for $8,000, and he put a new coat of paint on it. And because a lot of black families were coming out of tenements and ghetto housing, they didn't understand a whole lot about sophisticated mortgage instruments. So they would take that house and mark it up to $15,000. Because the white family wouldn't know any better about what they were buying and would be in such a pinch that they had no choice but to sign the papers. So then the black families are buying artificially inflated real estate. So it was very much a scam, and it was done by real estate interests and brokers to take advantage of white people and black people's mistrust of each other.
Yeah, it's profitable for some people when people are divided like that. I suppose it's always been the case. Now, in the book, you get into a lot of detail and you explain very well how the federal government actually played a part in some policies that led to urban blight and pushed along the continued social segregation that we're still seeing today. Can you, as quickly as possible, talk a little bit about that?
Well, I could take up the next hour talking about that. But, you know, the basic gist of it is that, you know, in the South, Jim Crow was sort of the law. You know, it was a legal system of segregation. And so black people and white people actually lived in relative proximity because, A, southern towns just weren't that big. Birmingham and Atlanta were the biggest cities you had, and even back then they weren't that large. And so, you know, but blacks and whites stayed out of each other's way because of legal strictures and social customs. Well, they didn't have that in the North. They didn't have the same legal structures in place. And so when blacks started moving north, because they didn't have these legal protections legal discrimination, you know, blacks started moving into white neighborhoods and white people started getting scared. And so some, you know, as with anything else in America, once somebody tries to figure out how to incorporate and make a profit off of something, they'll do it. And so what happened in the North was that Jim Crow was really privatized, and that real estate developers realized that if you created all white real estate, you could sell it at a premium and that had a value. And so they started putting in real estate contracts that, you know, certain homes could only be sold to whites and whole neighborhoods could only be sold to whites. And that created, you know, a premium real estate property. And this sort of thinking about white real estate being worth more than black real estate gradually became codified in the real estate industry practice through the teens and the 20s. And then by the 30s, during the Great Depression, when the federal government wanted to get into the mortgage business and encourage home ownership to try and get us out of the Great Depression, You know, just like the federal government now, when they want to write healthcare laws, who do they go to? They go to the insurance companies and get their private lobbyists to write the law for them. Same thing happened with real estate interests in the 1930s. And so the real estate developers who had a vested interest in creating more all-white real estate basically wrote the federal policies about mortgage underwriting so that federal mortgage guidelines, the government could not underwrite mortgages in black neighborhoods. Those neighborhoods were what was called redlined, and they were cut off from any and all mortgage capital whatsoever. And all the mortgage capital flooded into white neighborhoods, and white people were able to invest in better real estate, earn a better return on it, and became vested in the notion that they're keeping their land and keeping their property all white is necessary for their well-being. And so they fought even harder when blacks tried to integrate. And so we created a huge engine of wealth creation for white America, and black America was just completely left out of it.
Mm. Now, onto the third part of your book, you had a good starting point based on personal knowledge of the advertising industry, but that's not the only reason that you chose to include that whole section of the book. Why is advertising important to this discussion of racial separation?
Well, advertising is important because advertising, like movies or music or any other culture, tells us a lot about who we are. As you know, it sets the national narrative of what we think of ourselves as Americans. And in the 1960s, you basically had Aunt Jemima or Uncle Rastus, the cream of wheat, you know, guy. And you had the only place black people existed in advertising was as the help. And that sort of informed people's thinking of what America was. Because advertising, is, you know, it sells you an idea based on the lifestyle you want to aspire to. You know, if cool people are using iPods, then you want to use an iPod too. And so if, you know, no black people were included in advertising, then no one would ever aspire to anything to do with being black. And so it was necessary from a cultural point of view to integrate the industry. And it was also necessary from an employment point of view to integrate the industry. And the failure to do so really shaped the world that I sort of inherited when I went into advertising about, 30 years later. And the fact that we had a segregated advertising industry meant that I didn't know or work with or meet any black people in all my years of working there.
Understood. In the fourth and final part of your book, you tackle, as if race was not touchy enough, you get into the separation of the races as far as churches, and you have a lot of experience. You grew up in the Catholic Church in Louisiana. And the Catholic Church of all churches, you know, they're very clear and specific theology that, you know, we're all one body in Christ. And yet you delineate all these battles that happen clearly along racial lines. And in that section of the book, you write, separatism begets separatism. First you adjust to it, then you come to prefer it, then you can't live without it. Would you say, given that sentence and given everything that you've learned and been through since writing the book, are you hopeful that we will become less separated socially?
I think that I'll caveat that. I think some people will. You know, what's happening now is you have, minority populations in America are exploding, you know, really exponentially. And you have to, you know, sort of ask yourself, well, what does that mean? People are saying, oh, we're going to be a majority-minority country. But, you know, white people aren't going anywhere. The statistic is that in 2042, white people will only be half of the population. But when you think about that, that's still a whole lot of white people.
Right.
And, you know, white people will still control most of the resources and money in this society. And so what you'll have is you'll have a large population of Hispanic and Asian, and to a certain extent, black Americans sort of assimilating into that population. And, you know, a lot of mixed race people and you know, children of interracial marriages. And you'll have a large swath of white America that, you know, is really accepting of that and really just doesn't mind. And, you know, that's going to constitute the new majority. And then, you know, on the periphery, you're going to have white people who are still hung up on America being a white country. And if they're not able to get along with or deal with or cope with, you know, blacks being part of the majority, then, you know, they won't be able to function in this new society that they're creating. And that's also, you know, similar and true of minorities that don't want to assimilate in the majority either. You know, they're going to have a hard time adjusting to what is essentially a beige majority as opposed to a white one.
Right, right. Is there anything else that you think our listeners ought to know?
I think the main thing that you ought to know is that it starts with you. And that's what I learned, and that's what I tried to accomplish with this book. I didn't undertake this project to, start a conversation about race or anything really noble or big minded like that. I did it because I was curious and I wanted to know more. And, I wanted to learn about the role of race in shaping my life, which is why I looked at my high school, my neighborhood, my church, my ad agency. And so, it really just starts with your own curiosity and your own initiative to reach out and learn more about other people.